This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Now, yesterday and today, our theater's been jammed with newspapermen and hundreds of photographers from all over the nation, and these veterans agree with me that the city never has witnessed the excitement stirred by these youngsters from Liverpool who call themselves the Beatles. Now, tonight, you're going to twice be entertained by them, right now and again in the second half of our show. Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
50 years ago this week, the Beatles landed on U.S. soil. They captivated fans, apparently desperate for something to scream about. It was February of 1964, and America was still reeling from the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. The Beatles provided an ecstatic respite from the gloom, and the screaming hordes that greeted them spawned a movement and a new term. Beatlemania. Author and journalist Penelope Rowland was among the screaming hordes. There's a famous photograph to prove it. As a grown-up, she's been a writer for several different publications and is author of a new anthology called The Beatles Are Here, 50 Years After the Band Arrived in America. Writers, musicians, and other fans remember. Penelope Rowland, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
It seems that when we talk about this moment in history that people knew at the time, the Beatles were going to be huge. Regular people and budding musicians all knew that this was a defining moment. But why and how?
It's interesting, as I looked back at what the phenomenon was like, I remembered that we heard about the screaming girls long before we heard about the music. So I was part of the wave of screaming young women who were caught up in a frenzy. I'm not sure people knew how good the Beatles were. It took a while. At first, they were just a phenomenon. They were sort of cartoon figures. They looked funny. People, our parents were horrified. They were funny and rude, and they made us laugh, and they were irreverent. But I think the music is something that came quite slowly to us, how good it was and how long it would last, how they might endure as a band.
I'm trying to imagine what it must be like for parents, you know, who are watching the Ed Sullivan Show, used to watching, you know, Edie Gourmet or, you know, a plate spinner or something like that.
Yes.
Suddenly seeing their own children screaming, girls screaming. What was happening?
I don't know. But all I know is we knew we would scream. And I remember sitting in the family living room. I was the only preteen girl in the house. And I was screaming to the annoyance of my family, and I think this scenario was taking place all across the country.
Well, personally for you, your face is actually on the cover of the book. You are one of those girls screaming, anguished look on your face. But there's a personal story for you. It was a pretty tumultuous time for you.
It was. My mother had remarried and gone off on her honeymoon, and I'm sure that had stirred up all sorts of emotions for me. And I was simultaneously madly in love with George Harrison. It was my first true love, and I was convinced he was my destiny, unlike anyone else in America, of course. And so my mother left town and left us with our maternal grandmother, and as she walked out the door, she said, "Do not go down to the Beatles Hotel and scream while I'm away." Well, of course, I went. I had to go. You couldn't not. So I was promptly out the door, and I went down, and this picture was taken. My mother comes back a couple of days later, and the New York Times runs a photograph of me, screaming, the very photo that's on the cover of the book. And that evening, the phone begins to ring with people saying, "Isn't that Penelope in the newspaper today?"
Boy, were you in trouble.
I was in such hot water.
Well, everybody has their own story, and you access so many of them. I'm going to go through the details of some of them. Michael Lavin, another fan, he writes about being cooped up in a hospital bed at Mass General. He's with a 6'11 basketball player from San Francisco. His memory on the Ed Sullivan Show was crystal clear, he writes. "It's like where you were when Kennedy was shot, the same level of clarity," which brings up an interesting point about timing and about generational memory, I think. Do you think that the Beatles did take on a larger-than-life aspect and influence because their performance was just about 3 months after Kennedy's assassination?
You know, it's not a point I ever would have thought, that the two would be linked. And this is something that came up over and over as I spoke to people. And I absolutely think there's a connection. I think that the world was so gray. And I remember it specifically because I remember walking home from, I lived in New York City, and seeing the grown-ups lurching towards me. We were sent home early from school, and seeing grown-ups crying everywhere you looked. And then 6 weeks later, the Beatles are here, and we're out in the streets again. And I have to think that the media really, really pushed the story because it was such a breath of fresh air.
Mm. Billy Joel writes about going from loving Beethoven and Chopin and classical geniuses to deciding to become a musician because of the Beatles. Bruce Springsteen recalls painting his aunt's house to raise money to buy a guitar after hearing them play. Are you surprised by how many musicians list the Beatles as the very reason that they became musicians?
I was, and also, or they changed focus. I remember Bob Dylan at some point, I quote in the book, as saying he knew when he heard them that music was going in a new direction, and he had to go. So even if they weren't becoming musicians, they were shifting radically. There's even someone in the book, he's not well known, but who threw in the towel, gave up being a musician when he heard them, because he knew he couldn't reach that level.
We're speaking with Penelope Rollins. She's a freelance writer and the author of a compilation called The Beatles Are Here. These are a collection of stories and remembrances of people, fans and some non-fans, of the Beatles arriving in the United States 50 years ago this month. One of the stories is also a mass media story of the time, Cousin Brucey's story about Ringo's St. Christopher medal being stolen and how he got it back. Tell us a little bit more about Cousin Brucey and what happened.
Cousin Brucey was such a huge, huge name then. I mean, he was the person we all listened to on the radio at night, and it was fascinating to talk to him again all those years later. The fans were frightening at times, and that's a point he makes, that it was, you know, the band was not always happy about screaming, frenetic girls surrounding their cars and all kinds of things like that. It was a volatile situation, and at one point, Ringo came to the studio, I guess, really upset because he'd been pounced upon by a group of girls, and one had taken this St. Christopher medal he wore around his neck. So Cousin Brucey was alert to the public relations aspect of this story. I mean, there was such competition among the disc jockeys who could be closest to the Beatles, who would get the share of the ratings. And Brucey didn't miss a beat, apparently. He went on the air, and he offered a reward, no questions asked, if you find it, and you can come on, and he'll kiss you on the air. And so sure enough, a girl appeared, and that was a big, it can be seen on YouTube, actually, to this day, the moment when she's a bit ashamed, I think, appears, but she does get her reward, and he gets his medal back.
Mm. You include some essays from people who weren't particularly fans. What did you think when you read their perspectives on the time and on the music?
Well, I thought the one who really stood out was Fran Lebowitz, who's, and I did
so
describe
funny.
Her as a non-fan. And that was an interview, and I called her up and asked if she'd talk to me, and she said, well, I didn't like the Beatles, and I thought, oh, bingo, because I really wanted a diverse group. So someone as articulate as she, talking about why she didn't like the Beatles, I had a feeling she'd have a lot of great things to say.
And in fact, she told you a fantastic story about many years later being at the same party with Paul McCartney. What happened?
She was sitting on a piano bench and it must have been quite a glamorous New York City party, and all of a sudden Paul McCartney sits down next to her, and it turns out he's about to play for the assembled guests, and she turns to him, classic Fran Lebowitz, and says, excuse me, I'm having a conversation here, which must have been the first time that's ever happened to him. She did not want to be interrupted, but he did go on and play.
Well, beyond this moment when the nation needed a sort of balm, as you were describing earlier, after the assassination of Kennedy, the Beatles went on for almost a full decade and then many decades more in our imagination. Did they indeed forever change things?
I think so. And that was the final and most wonderful lesson of doing all this research, was there was a reason they were so famous and they were the sinecure of all eyes. And the reason was they were that good. And what I found fascinating was to talk to different musicians about in what way they were good. They saw what they were doing in ways I couldn't see as a non-musician. But the other thing that was wonderful about them, yes, it was brief, but they kept moving ahead. And I remember almost being dismayed as the albums came out, because you'd be expecting one thing, and it was never there. It was something altogether different. And then in a short period of time, everyone was doing that too. So they were phenomenally inventive.
Penelope, I just want to make sure that you've gotten over the fact that you and George never did get together.
I know. Well, it's strange. I'm not angry with him anymore, because what happened is I shifted allegiance to Paul. And Paul I'm really angry with, because for the last 10 years I've lived in New Jersey, and he went and married another Jersey girl. I'm furious. So now I'm mad at him, too.
Well, I'm glad you got over it well enough to write the book. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Author and journalist Penelope Rowland. She's written for several publications, including The Daily Beast and Vogue. Her latest book is an anthology. It's called The Beatles Are Here, 50 Years After the Band Arrived in America, Writers and Musicians and Other Fans Remember. It's a compilation of reflections from a whole host of Beatle fans, and I guess some not so much fans. You can find more in the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming may be home to the most popular ski resorts here in the U.S., but when it comes to tough conditions, New Hampshire dominates. When Word of Mouth continues, we're going to look into the history of skiing in New Hampshire and why our state grooms so many stellar winter athletes. And then while I'm away,